Hello, everybody. I hope you are well. Matt and I are taking the weekend off as it's the Easter weekend, so we plan to enjoy some chocolate and time of our families. So today we're posting up an episode of Extra Shot. Extra Shot is our Patreon-only show that comes immediately after Espresso Martini. So I wanted to share an episode to give you a taster, and if you like it, please consider subscribing to our Patreon page and you'll get two episodes of Extra Shot a month. So this episode is dated from the 2nd of March 2024, and in it we look at recommendations for a shake-up of British intelligence, the arrest of an alleged member of the Red Army faction in Germany. We also look at the conviction of a left-wing terrorist in the UK, and a cyber attack against an Iranian spy ship. So I hope you enjoyed this episode, and I hope you have a fantastic Easter weekend. Take care. And welcome to Extra Shot. If you're listening to this, you're directly supporting the show. Thank you very much for doing that. Matt, how are you doing? It was quite a long episode in the end, wasn't it?
Yeah, I'm doing good. Ready to keep going. We got a few more interesting articles here to discuss. Thanks
indeed.
For listening, everybody.
Yeah, thank you, everybody. And so, yeah, well, let's kick off then. You've got a great piece that you picked about intelligence chiefs from Britain calling for a shake-up of how we do things here in the UK. So do you want to talk to us about that?
Yeah, so at the recent Munich Security Conference, the former heads of the UK's GCHQ and MI6, Sir Jeremy Fleming and Sir Alex Younger, advocated for a modern restructuring of the UK's intelligence services. Traditional divisions between domestic, foreign, and signals intelligence are outdated in the contemporary security landscape, they said. They argued for the integration of capabilities over territorial disputes within intelligence agencies. Fleming highlighted that differentiating between domestic and foreign threats is increasingly irrelevant in today's context. The focus should shift towards organizing intelligence services according to the threats they counter and the safety of the populations they serve. Discussions revolved around the British government's data collection and utilization for various security purposes, including traditional and emerging threats such as healthcare sector vulnerabilities. Younger suggested that if intelligence services were established today, they would be structured differently, urging against fetishizing organizational boundaries. Despite facing persistent terrorism threats, Britain is considered advanced in integrating intelligence capabilities due to its smaller size and experience. Fleming noted significant changes in the composition of intelligence agencies, highlighting a departure from easily distinguishable roles among different agencies. Chris, what'd you think of this one?
No, it was a good one. It's funny, you just mentioned Alex Younger, and a memory just popped into my head, a really random one. Last year, I was just walking around Whitehall, and guess who I spotted?
Alex Younger.
Exactly. And I was like, shit, there's the former C head of MI6. And I was wondering, and then afterwards, I thought, I wonder how many people would recognize
him. Know that that's who he was. Yeah.
It's me, like, kind of, fangirling or fanboying or whatever over the former head of MI6 as I saw him. I was like, bloody hell. You know, it's like a celebrity, but, you know, a very select circle of celebrity, I guess. But yeah. But no, very interesting piece. And obviously, so they're arguing for a single integrated agency as opposed to the traditional three. And I suspect on some level that would be more economically minded and probably even operationally more effective. Because obviously the reliance on tech and intelligence gathering today, you can kind of see why there's that natural integration. But the idea of a single agency might not be popular in certain sections of the British public. I remember one of the subplots of, was it Spectre, was around this sort of new, single, all-seeing, all-knowing spy agency run by Andrew Scott as C, which apparently may not have stood for, Cummings? Because C's a reference to... Oh, God, is it Lord Mansfield Cumming, who was the first MI6 head? Rather than the other C word that Ralph Fiennes mentioned. But anyway.
I don't know why I just thought it meant chief.
It might do that too, but it's supposed to be a nod to Man Feels Coming, because he was always just known as C. I think, like, I don't know whether it was like some weird abbreviation of his name. People just called him C. I mean, I know somebody who refers to himself by his two initials and his wife by her two initials. So, you know, it does happen.
Corporate and formalized and relationship.
Yeah. And did you know green's a spy color in Britain? So hence why our logo's green, because C writes with green ink, and he's the only person in MI6 and I think the entire intelligence community who writes in green ink. And if you ever go to the National Archives, sometimes you're lucky to find a document that has been signed by one of the C's over the years, and it's always quite exciting to see it. So it's like, ah, wow.
Yeah. I didn't know the green ink part.
Yeah. So whatever. So with this, as I was saying about this sort of public perception, for this single agency to be publicly accepted in the UK, I think there will need to be a better effort to educate people on the real life functions of intelligence. So people not drawing on James Bond or slow horses as their reference point. Because I think at the moment there probably will be a fear that it's going to be like the Stasi or something, and people just lose their spadoinkle over a single agency. I could just see it now. But from a general election point of view, if the intelligence community can turn around and say, hey, we could be more cost effective and more effective, I could see the next government, whoever that may be, might well consider this. But I think operationally, one of the plus sides of splitting your agencies up is if there is a bad actor among them, a mole, then they only get access to so much information rather than the whole picture. But then saying that, we're in a different world now. So it probably, even if you work for MI6, you probably could get access to GCHQ stuff if you know what you're doing. Same with MI5, you could probably get hold of MI6 stuff if you know what you're doing, because we're also computer-based now.
Right.
So who knows? But yeah, so what were your thoughts, Mal, on that?
I was sort of thinking about, like, how you would actually do it, you know? Like okay,
what building would they have?
What would it look like
in
practice, you know? Like, would you collapse? So, okay, you have MI6, MI5, GCHQ, Defense Intelligence. You're not going to get defense intelligence out of the MOD, nor do I think should you.
I think it would just be the standard three, the civilian run ones rather than the military one.
You would just collapse them together. Mm. But then you have sort of like, you have essentially like the KGB, which did it all, you know, which is not a good comparison that you want. I mean, I think historically that sort of firewall between foreign and domestic intelligence has been sort of centered around civil liberties and stuff, right?
Yeah.
But at least that's how it is here in terms of like the FBI and the CIA, you know, but MI5 is not really comparable to the FBI. I mean, the FBI is a law enforcement agency that does a whole lot more than just national security, whereas the MI5 is more just a domestic intelligence service.
Yeah, because we've got the National Crime Agency. It gets a bit murky because you got you had Special Branch, which has sort of turned into, I think, SO15 now, which is to do with counterterrorism. So they have the powers to arrest, because basically, as you were saying, MI5 are not law enforcement, they don't have
that's
the powers
under the Met.
To arrest. Yeah, and so MI5, should they be on an operation where somebody's going to be arrested, they go with Special Branch, and Special Branch do the arresting. And I know there's resentment amongst MI5 and Special Branch, more on the Special Branch side, because the police officers feel like they're treated like gophers for MI5 employees sometimes. So it's, there's a lot of cultural things that will probably need to change a bit over time.
It's also just interesting when you consider, like, the internal structure of UK and European intelligence services are remarkably opaque compared to their US counterparts. Like, we know a lot about how the CIA, not so much NSA, but still, we know a lot about how these agencies are organized and how they run and just like just the nuts and bolts of how they work. And that's not, I don't know, I think you would sort of, most people, their first instinct would be to think that the Europeans are more sort of open and transparent with their intelligence operations, and they're not. You know?
No. America, seriously, is much more open. The fact that we have been able to interview people, and, you know, our first interview with somebody who worked for MI6, I have to disguise his voice. You know, that's a big difference. Big difference.
It's just, like, sort of surprising to me. Yeah. Like, wow, you guys are nuts about that. Merida, it seems like everyone who comes out of everyone who comes out of the CIA has a book to write.
Yeah, it's always a given now, isn't it?
Sort of. I mean, there's that running joke about like the Navy SEALs too, you know, every one of them has to write a book or, you know, have some sort of brand deal afterwards, which, you know, it definitely isn't, that's not a good thing. I don't think that it's just interesting the thought how you would do that. But you don't really have like after 9/11, you know, we have like the Office of the Director of National Intelligence, which sort of oversees the whole community, which was supposed to break apart some of the stovepiping when the director of the CIA was, I guess, nominally the head of the intelligence community. You don't really have, I mean, you have like the Joint Intelligence Committee that's under the cabinet office, but it's not quite the same. It's more like an analytical kind of a organization than it is like operational budgetary control, that kind of stuff.
Yeah. Well, I think it's supposed to be there to hold the heads of the agencies to account should they need to be. And it's just there to kind of keep things kosher, really, I think, is its main function.
The CIA station chief is on that committee, I believe, or at least sits in on it and observes. It's one of the perks of the job.
Yeah. Well, I suppose with that, what you're just saying there, I mean, that really just shows that sort of special relationship between Britain and America with regards to intelligence. I think the whole Five Eyes thing is still, you know, taken very seriously and is still, you know, very important. And I think, if anything, for Britain, I think the school of thought is that we usually do human intelligence very well, and we tend to be a bit more reliant on the Americans for technological support because America has bigger budgets than we do. And I think that's where a lot of that sort of special relationship kind of comes from.
And that sort of signals intelligence enterprise between NSA, GCHQ, the Canadian, Australian, and New Zealand counterparts, it's all kind of just one integrated structure, essentially. You know, they're all based at each other's locations and stuff. And we covered a story about an NSA officer who got into a sort of a domestic issue with a GCHQ employee. You know, remember that?
Yeah, I do.
He was working at Cheltenham.
Yeah, and then he got radicalized, didn't he, and stuff. And it's an interesting one, that one. Okay, well, we'll move on to, there's a piece about an arrest of a lady named Daniela Klett, who was arrested in Germany for alleged links to the Red Army faction. Klett was in hiding for 30 years, and she's now 65 years old, and she faces charges of attempted murder and serious robberies. A second individual who's yet to be identified was also arrested alongside Klett, and I think possibly because of German law, they generally don't name the suspect other than, I think it's their, is it their second initial they use?
It's something their, like that. I think they give the first initial of the surname.
That's it. So it'd be like Bob F. or something like that, you know, Yeah, so we might find out whoever that person is. But with Klett, because she's a well-known fugitive, I guess it bypasses that rule, maybe? I don't know. But anyway, the Red Army faction, or the RAF, not the Royal Air Force, they were a far-left armed group that terrorized Germany for decades, and they're responsible for numerous violence acts targeting political figures and business leaders. They were active between 1971 and 1993. And their alleged crimes included bombings, assassinations, and attacks on government institutions, resulting in 34 deaths and over 200 injuries over their time. Daniela Klett was accused of belonging to the RAF's third generation, who were active in the 1980s to the very early 1990s, and they carried out high-profile attacks, including the assassination of the Deutsche Bank chairman and a centre-left politician. Traces of Klett's DNA were actually found at the site of a gun attack on the US embassy in Bonn in 1991, and her DNA has also been linked to a more recent robbery in 2016 when she and some former RAF associates allegedly tried to rob an armored vehicle. That robbery was not successful. So she's a very interesting person there who managed to evade detection for 30 years. So Matt, do you have any thoughts on that one?
I think being on the run in Germany for that long is quite a feat, you know, and almost it's curious that she wouldn't have fled Germany to, say, like Russia or Syria or some socialist country in Latin America, you know, where she could have just been gone and sort of had that because that, you know, that's the Red Army faction is a classical leftist terrorist organization and, you know, would still be seen quite sympathetically by a number of countries.
Well, yeah, and people on the very, very far left of politics, like anarchists and stuff, would be like, oh, they're heroes and stuff.
Yeah.
They were trying to take down capitalism, basically. Yeah,
yeah, that was my biggest thing, surprised to see her in Germany still after all this time, and how she managed to stay, you know, on the run.
Well, yeah, especially in this day and age. I mean, my thoughts on that, because I was thinking that too. I mean, like, one thing I've learned from watching a ridiculous amount of true crime shows is apparently 9 times out of 10, most long-term fugitives do live in close proximity to where they lived previously. And that somehow, either it's the familiarity of the area helps them evade detection, or the authorities after a while just give up on that area and move and look elsewhere. It's an interesting one, that one, but it's quite common actually that the suspect will be found quite near where they used to live. And I wonder as well, like, she may have, because in Europe you've got the whole Schengen agreement, you can skip the border without being challenged, so it might be she skipped the border for a while and then came back when she may have laid, you know, went off to some other place for quite a few years and then slowly slipped back, especially she's getting older. Maybe she was sort of starting to reminisce a little bit about her hometown or something.
I mean, know.
You know, going a bit there, but yeah, it's an interesting one.
Like, she could have gone to Cuba and had a very good life, and still would have a very good life.
Yeah,
of course.
Yeah,
then there's how do you get there? But I don't.
Well, she could have. I mean, she probably could have done. Back in the 90s, it would have been easier to get a fake ID that would still work, because now a lot of it's
biometrics,
connected to DNA, biometrics and stuff. Yeah. So it's much harder. And but at least with Europe, you could do a little very long road trip to certain points and then take a boat somewhere, I guess, do the reverse of but then you have to go through some dodgy war zones to kind of get to somewhere, wouldn't you? It'd be quite difficult. But I think in the 90s it would have been a lot easier. Maybe she even did do that and came back. It could be, you know, it might be she came back. We'll find out more, I'm sure, as the trial kicks off at some point. But the other thing about Red Army Faction I was just gonna add was, you know, it was sort of it was believed to be run by East German intelligence and a proxy for the KGB to create instability in the West, or in West Germany. And it was interesting that the Red Army Faction and other leftist terrorist groups sort of collapsed after the Soviet Union collapsed. And certainly as well, some Middle Eastern terrorist groups sort of folded up and so on when the Soviet Union collapsed.
Well, the Palestinian the Palestinian groups up until Hamas and when the Iranians came in, they were all classical leftist terrorist organizations. They weren't weren't religiously ideological.
No, indeed. And quite a few of them sort of fell apart or forced to the peace table or attempted to after the lack of Soviet financing. So, yeah, I don't see the Red Army Faction itself coming back, but I am sort of fearful that the environment we're in now of political and social division and rising inequality and growing popularity of anti-capitalist talking points, and also to that fascist talking points, that we may at some point see a far leftist group like the Red Army Faction come to life in Europe. So yeah, I was that one really intrigued me, and I thought I'd bring it up because I've always found far leftist terrorism quite an interesting topic that I haven't done enough on it. A lot of the books are by authors who've passed on, because it was a long time ago that it was a kind of interesting and fashionable topic. And also, sadly as well, when it comes to far left terrorism, it tends to attract very right wing authors who then use it as a way to tarnish all left-wing ideology and so on. And so they're very few really reliable narrators on left-wing terrorism that you could really say were objective about it, but there we go. So but yeah, needs to, any recommendations, I'm obviously happy to take them. So if there's anybody surviving authors out there who want to talk to me about the Red Army Faction and stuff, and who can speak English as well, because it's a German topic, I'd love to chat with them about that. But there we go. Should we move on?
Yeah, it's a good segue to the next one, if you want to do that.
Well, yeah. So the next one kind of links straight into my fears here, because we've had a terrorism story in the UK that's being linked to far-left ideology. I'm going to use an article titled Left-Wing Anarchist Guilty of Terror Offences After Declaring He Wants to Kill 50 People, which is from Sky News. And so this 20-year-old man named Jacob Graham from Liverpool has been found guilty of preparing acts of terrorism by creating and disseminating a bomb-making manual titled The Freedom Encyclopedia. Despite being acquitted of planning specific terrorist attacks, Graham was convicted for his involvement in compiling terrorist publications and possessing documents useful for terrorism. Graham's manual, dedicated to terrorists past and future, contained instructions on creating explosives and evading law enforcement. So I'm sure it's quite good bedtime reading. And he was allegedly motivated by anarchist ideologies and a desire to combat what he perceived as government oppression. And Graham expressed intentions to target government buildings and politicians' residences, aiming to cause significant harm. Graham idolized Theodore Kaczynski, known as the Unabomber, and sought to emulate his acts of violence against societal structures. Through video diaries and online communications, Graham expressed disdain for government control, ecological concerns, and support for radical leftist ideologies, positioning himself as a revolutionary figure. Apparently, he utilized platforms like Discord and Telegram, and he engaged with like-minded individuals in groups advocating for anti-government sentiments and violent actions. He shared his bomb-making manual online and stored a collection of terrorist publications, fostering a network of individuals sharing his extremist views. Apparently, Graham conducted experiments with chemicals purchased online, burying some in the woodlands in a hideout for future use. And upon his arrest, a cache of chemicals capable of producing explosive mixtures were found, prompting concerns about his preparations for potential violent acts and a desire for societal collapse. So, yeah, an interesting one, that one. I don't know what your thoughts were. I'll save mine until you've said yours.
Yeah, a couple of things here. First thing that I found interesting was his plans to produce a 3D printed assault rifle, which is certainly interesting considering the UK's strict gun laws compared to ours, where you could just go out and just buy an AR-15. So I think, you know, would the barrier to entry for him to operationalizing some plan, would that be a lot lower in the US and it would be in the UK? You know what I mean? You don't have to go through the trouble of...
He could have just gone to Walmart.
In some states, just walk into Walmart and buy one, which is crazy. But anyway, the other thing that I found interesting was he was apparently inspired by a Netflix documentary about Ted Kaczynski, the Unabomber.
Was it the documentary or the drama? Because there was a really good drama called Manhunt Unabomber.
Oh, yes. That's what it was.
That was
that's
really
what it was.
Good.
The Netflix,
really good.
Okay, docuseries, a show, fictionalized show about, about that, which is sort of, I don't know, like you could see, I'm not saying that we shouldn't have programs like this or anything. I mean, I'm arguably kind of making one myself that I have these very same concerns about it. But, you know, could you see like a young person on who has far right sort of ideology see a documentary or a show about like Timothy McVeigh and that's how they discover it, you know?
Yeah. I think from a psychology point of view, I think those kind of people have a predisposition to do something. So
they're going to do it anyway.
They would literally find anything that would then make them go to the next level, if you know what I mean.
But to your point, I was just saying, to your point then also that you were talking about this in the last segment about how, I don't know, far left terrorism has had historically waned a bit since the collapse of the Soviet Union. But I think, I mean, there's a lot of reasons to suspect that it may get a resurgence. You know, I'm thinking of like the war in Gaza and how that's been received among progressives, especially young people in the West. Not saying that everyone who has an issue with Israel's conduct in the war is destined to, you know, blow up a building or something, but that is certainly...
People have done it in the past.
That profound sort of rage and outrage is in the bloodstream now. And that definitely has consequences in the extreme. You know, like, do you think also, like, a lot of the issues we're having around tech and the coming AI revolution and its sort of economic and societal consequences, it makes a ripe environment for radicalization. You know, like, okay, there was a story here recently that like Wendy's, the fast food chain, was sort of like exploring the possibility of doing dynamic pricing on their menu, you know? So like, okay, if there's a time that it's seen that, you know, there's a lot of people who want to buy like a Baconator, like a bacon cheeseburger, that the prices will go up based on the demand, which,
extortion.
yes. I mean, okay, dynamic pricing for a hotel room, a plane ticket, a concert ticket, an Uber. I see that. But like just doing that kind of capitalism for a fucking burger just because you can is the kind of stuff that leads most people to think maybe we should get out the guillotines, you know?
Yeah.
It's that kind of that kind of just rampant, fuck you, I got mine, you're going to suffer capitalism that leads, that makes that kind of stuff that this guy was arrested for very attractive to people.
You remind me of something Anthony Bourdain once said about the show Man v. Food, because when he was in the Middle East and in third world countries, Man v. Food was constantly on in a place where people are starving. And they took that show as representative of ordinary Americans. And so they thought all Americans were just acting like the man on Man v. Food. And it suddenly, you know, made all Americans kind of, should we say, greedy and gross in that context. Not I'm saying Adam Richman's greedy and gross, but the show is sort of about these sort of competitions about how much food you can eat and stuff. So it's a bit distasteful. And if you're in like Ethiopia or something where there's like a famine, I think Man v. Food is the last thing that you're going to want to see on television. And if you're angry, you might start to resent it. So it's interesting how these sort of things can do that. And I think, you know, Anthony Bourdain didn't mince his words. I think he said this is like a recruitment tool for Al-Qaeda or something.
He's right.
That's how he described it.
He's right.
So like, as you say about this dynamic pricing, it's going to, when people are starving and they're suddenly seeing like companies profiting off it. But it's like with the energy crisis over here. So our prices have gone up quite dramatically in the UK. And the reason we were told they've gone up is because energy demand, the energy crisis across Europe and stuff makes energy demand harder to cater for, hence why it's more expensive. Yet these companies are making an massive profit. And it's like something's not computing there, because the only reason we're supposed to be paying more money is because it's harder to get, yet you're posting record profit. So something's gone wrong somewhere, you know. And so put that times 1,000 with the AI thing and suddenly joblessness and 40% of jobs disappearing. I can see a lot of instability coming and a lot of people from different factions wanting to do something about it. But
I mean, that's also like, I mean, we've had the same issues here, you know, around like inflation, you know. It sort of started coming back online after COVID, which if you consider like, okay, we're coming out of a once in a century trauma and disruption that no one alive has ever dealt with before, ever experienced, right? No. Like, things are going to be kind of weird and wacky. It's going to take us a bit to get back to normal, you know? And I think in many ways there just was a lot of impatience around that, right? But, and yes, inflation was an issue for a bit, still continues to be in some regard. Prices are going down. Like, just you look at the numbers, like they are. But in many respects, they haven't gone down as quickly as they should, because companies just don't just keep prices higher and just use inflation as an excuse to do so, just to gouge people. And that's, to the point about, you know, Wendy's was looking at doing that with their menu, just doing that with food, with a burger, simply because you can. Is just like, that's something to me that I'm just like, that's insane. Like, if you do that, you are morally rotten to the core. And I don't know, there's a part of me that thinks, if something bad happens to you because of that, like, you asked for it.
And what was that burger you mentioned?
It's called the Baconator.
What the kind of name is that? It's really weird.
That's an American name right there, Chris. That's America.
Is it like the Terminator meets bacon or something?
I'm not the type to eat a Baconator, but I think it's like a double bacon cheeseburger. So like two patties with a whole bunch of bacon and cheese. It's, I don't know. When you're over here, I will take you to get a Baconator and you can, a Baconator and one of those massive 24-ounce coffees that I had that one day that couldn't get past.
the Pedro Pascal cup, Well, Wendy's is opened in the UK. I haven't been to one, and I have no idea whether the Baconator is available over here, but I'll take you up on your offer. Come to
go
the
check
east
if
side.
They have, if they have a, if they have a Baconator.
Well, I'm going to try and sort out an East Coast trip in the next 18 months. I just need a, because I've got a trip to New Zealand coming up I need to pay for first. But I'm hoping to come East Coast some point mid next year, because I need to go to Baltimore, I need to go to DC and stuff. So it'd be good to, definitely meet up in person and have a Baconator.
Yes.
Back to this case for a moment. So one of the things that sort of I always find interesting and surprising, but it's not uncommon either, is that you find out I don't know, your son or daughter living in your house upstairs is plotting some terrible thing, and they've built bombs or they've collected an arsenal of weapons, and yet nobody in the family is aware of this. And I always find that a bit mind-boggling. And I know recently there was a mass shooting in the States where the mother has been convicted of like involuntary manslaughter because it was felt that she could have prevented her son from going on a mass shooting. And I can't remember where that was, but I read that briefly, I believe. Yeah,
Ohio?
Yeah.
And I think it was Ohio or Michigan.
Yeah. And I don't know enough of the details of this case to really pass any proper judgment on the family of Jacob Graham. I don't know. But I did sort of want to understand, like, just generally, how is it possible that somebody like this could go undetected in the family home? Because he lived with his mother, his sister, and his mother's partner. And so it could be a multitude of reasons, ranging from parents thinking it's a phase, being ignorant or uncaring as to the view their kids. They might just ignore them. There's also an element where there could be denial on the parent's side, thinking that their son or daughter couldn't do something terrible. Yeah, Timmy has weird views, but they're just weird views, right? No, Timmy's about to go and shoot up a mall. So there's a lot of sort of factors there. And also with the whole... this Jacob Graham, I do wonder, like with a lot of lone wolf, because he's sort of getting into that lone wolf category, because he didn't operate for a prescribed terrorist organization as far as we know. A lot of the time, these individuals are disaffected and not happy in their life, and you know, and he definitely comes across as that kind of person. And yeah, still at 20 years old living with his parents and stuff, which is a very common thing these days, but it isn't fun. I lived with my dad till I was like 31, I think, and it wasn't great at all, you know. And yeah, and it was, you know, there are many times you like think, shit, I should be doing better than this and stuff like that. So you do go through all sorts of kind of esteem issues and so on and so forth. And then on top of that, if your parents resent the fact that you still live there, that can add difficulties as well. A bit like that. Do you remember the beheading incident that we talked about in the last episode?
Yeah, in Pennsylvania.
That was connected to a potential family row, wasn't it? Which led to the guy beheading his dad, you know. But one thing I did want to bring up, so the signs of I wanted to look at what are the signs of radicalization, because I think I've got this feeling that a lot of people, a lot of parents in particular, are not aware of the signs of radicalization. And I went to the NSPCC website, which is a British charity so it's basically a charity against protection against child cruelty. And I went onto their website to find spotting the signs of radicalization. So I'm going to read them out a minute. So this is from the NSPCC website. So radicalization can be difficult to spot, and signs that may indicate a child is being radicalized include isolating themselves from friends and family, talking as if from a scripted speech, unwillingness or inability to discuss their views, a sudden disrespectful attitude towards others, increased levels of anger, increased secretiveness, especially around the use of the internet. So they add, children who are at risk of radicalization may have low self-esteem or be victims of bullying or discriminations. Extremists might target them and tell them they could be part of something special, later brainwashing them into cutting themselves off from their friends and family. However, the signs mentioned above don't necessarily mean a child is being radicalized. It may be normal teenage behavior and a sign of something else is wrong. So it's good to bear all those points in mind, because obviously secretive news around the internet of teenagers, that could be to do with porn, you know, or unwillingness or inability to discuss their views. Well, maybe they're just not in the mood, you know, there is that. But I think a lot of parents, just if they see these sort of things happening, it's just a good idea to have a chat with your teenage daughter or son and just check in on them to make sure everything's okay. Because, you know, because I just think if there's maybe like two or more of these points on that list that you could tick off, it might be worth just checking in on them to check that they're all right. Because you don't want your, you know, because there's so much extremist content on the internet you can get so easily now. And like, as with my own experiences of being a conspiracy theorist myself, it's very easy to go down this rabbit hole. It starts off quite harmless, but in some cases, as we've seen, it can become very serious. And I know of people who, yeah, there's a guy who was a conspiracy theorist for 18 years and finally came out of it, you know. So, and he's like in his mid-40s now. It's a big part of his life is sort of wasted on conspiracy theories and things. And, you know, it is very easy to get radicalized on the internet if you're not careful, especially when you're, you know, being a teenager is difficult, you know, especially in today's world, in today's economy, you know, trying to, especially when you leave, you know, there's 2 points when you're leaving school, so 3 points, leaving school, leaving senior high, which is sixth form college in the UK, and then leaving university. And those 3 points, depending on what level you're at, you're going into the workplace at some point, leaving one of those points. And trying to go into the workplace today and try and pursue something that you want to do is very tough, very tough. Much harder than probably it was 30 or 40 years ago. And so, you know, like, especially if you're living home with your parents and stuff, and then esteem comes into things, you know, you've got to bear all those things in mind. That can lead to people turning to things that are bad for them. So yeah, that's my PSA for the day, but but I just thought it was worth bringing that up. But I would like to, at some point, I do want to do an episode about the signs of radicalization. I'm just trying to work out who the best persons or person to talk to about that, because I have had the guys from Prevent on in the past. I would happily have them on again because I think they're decent guys and doing good work. But I do know there's this sort of very toxic debate around Prevent that might get in the way of the content of what they're saying. So if anybody listening has recommendations that could lead to an episode about the signs of radicalization, because I think there's a lot of parents who are just not aware that their kids can get radicalized on the internet, and just not aware of what their kids are looking at on the internet these days.
Failure of imagination, you know, to think that that's even possible.
Yeah, I know. But then there's a lot of parents out there today who are very hand to mouth as well, you know. And so kids can get left their own devices, and also their parents don't really understand technology, you know. They don't, I mean, maybe that's less of a case these days, but my dad, you know, what was, when I was in my early 20s, my dad wasn't, I mean, he was sort of clued up in technology, but he wasn't clued up on the internet and stuff. So it was like, you know, yeah, it's sort of a funny old one, really. But yeah, so maybe the people in their 20s now, maybe their parents are a bit more clued up on it. I don't know. But it's maybe, I think maybe people are not aware of the access you can get easily and how parental controls are almost useless now, aren't they?
Yeah, I don't. How kids get around some things, like they're going to find a way, you know?
And so, yeah. So if they're watching, so usually then it means they're either watching pornography or they're looking at beheading videos or something, you know. It's like,
or both,
or both, you know. And so that's quite a dodgy cocktail that I've painted right there. But yeah. So just, you know, parental controls can easily be subverted these days. So it's and also people, I think teenagers share a lot of stuff through, you know, private messaging. I mean, you know, you've seen sexting and all sorts of stuff happens, and there, yeah. And as this guy went on, was it Telegram? I forgot what I said now. Discord and Telegram, those sort of apps allow for private sharing and stuff. You can share all sorts of stuff. Even on Instagram, you can see stuff that's pretty dodgy.
I think back to, you know, you talk about like what kids now are sort of exposed to or just dealing with online and stuff they have access to 24 hours a day. Like, I was in high school in like the infancy of social media, right? And like the iPhone came out my senior year of high school. I didn't have a cell phone until I was probably about 16, 17, which was late. I was late to get a cell phone. But now, like, you have like five-year-olds, 6-year-olds with cell phones, which is insane to me. And that can do a whole lot more than the cell phone that I had when I was in high school. You know, like, we had social media, but it wasn't in our pockets all day long. You know, like, we didn't have access to it until we went home and logged in at the end of the day, into MySpace or Facebook or something. And I think like, if we had cameras, high quality cameras in our pockets and just the means to distribute it and to just, I don't know, all the stuff that you can do on it, on a smartphone, on a tablet, on social media today, if we had that stuff when I was their age, like in middle school and stuff, like I can't imagine some of the shit that would have gone down if we had the means to do it, you know?
An embarrassing photo could go around the entire school in seconds, you know?
Yeah. Yeah. And just not like not knowing any better, you know? And they don't know any better. They don't realize what they're doing.
No. Well, I don't know if this is me becoming a curmudgeon, but I'm just noticing parents and adults are telling children, they're not giving as much guidance on what you should and shouldn't do anymore. I mean, maybe I'm just being a curmudgeon here, but I just sometimes find it's more an attitude of just let them get on with it. And as long as they don't hurt themselves, it's okay.
Yeah.
I could be wrong on that, but it just feels that way sometimes, you know, especially seeing people let their kids run loose in public spaces, which my parents would never have allowed me to do. But maybe that's a generational thing. I don't know, but it just... Yeah.
I would have my ass beat.
Me too. Or the classic, as she's walking down a pavement and like there's you on your own, and then there's two adults and a kid, or one adult and two kids, and somebody's going to have to move out of the way to let you through, and they don't, and the parents say nothing, and I'm like, my parents would have made a hell of a thing about that. So anyway, there's me becoming an old man there, but take my flat cap off and leave that subject to another time. But I just think, you know, there is so much people are exposed to today from all over the world, you know, because I think it's the other thing I mentioned to some former conspiracy theorist friends occasionally is they don't realize that they're being targeted by foreign propaganda that wants to undermine your support for your own country. For them, that's a bit of a mind-blowing thing that they don't always believe it, but they kind of like sometimes that does sort of throw a few of them like, whoa, that exists.
Well, I think we're at a point now where a person could willingly sort of accept and like know it's foreign propaganda and fully accept it and agree with it because they've accepted the viewpoint that like that's correct. Like Russia, this conservative white Christian nation, they're right. Like, yes, I know it's Russian propaganda and I think they're right. You know, so you've sort of lost that. Like, do you know
The logical brain?
You know that you're, I don't know, the blue-haired they/them barista is a bigger threat than the Russian military. You know,
yeah, it's a weird one, but there we go. Is there anything else you want to add to this one, or should we move on?
Jump ahead to the spy ship, right?
Yes. So, you picked a great piece about the cyber attack on an Iranian spy ship. So, yeah, tell us about that.
Yes, this is a cool story here. It's called, the article we're using is called U.S. Conducted Cyber Attack on Suspected Iranian Spy Ship. It's from NBC News. So, the U.S. conducted a cyber attack on Iranian military ship suspected of collecting intelligence on cargo vessels in the Red Sea and the Gulf of Aden. The operation aimed to disrupt the ship's ability to share intelligence with Houthi rebels attacking cargo ships in the Red Sea. It was part of the Biden administration's response to an Iranian-backed drone attack in Iraq that killed 3 U.S. service members and wounded many others. The ship targeted was reportedly the MV Bashad, though its name was not officially disclosed by U.S. officials. Iran's U.N. ambassador denied the accusations, stating the ship was combating piracy and not aiding Houthi forces. Okay, sure. The Bashad has been operating near Djibouti, close to a Chinese military base, possibly as a deterrent against U.S. naval action. Houthi attacks since November have led shipping companies like Merck to pause operations in the Red Sea and the Gulf of Aden. The Houthi rebels, supported by Iran, vowed to continue attacks until Israel halts its military operations in Gaza. President Biden's response to the attack on U.S. soldiers included airstrikes in Iraq and Syria, cyber operations, and targeting Iranian-backed militants. Despite U.S. retaliation, Iran continues to provide support to its proxies in the region as it is wont to do. What do you think?
Well, when I first heard about the cyber attack, my response was good. there's been multiple comments from former intelligence officers and naval observers about this Iranian spy ship, and the consensus has largely been that the ship should be disabled. Now, I think most of them probably side on the idea it should be sunk. And I'm assuming this cyber attack is maybe just designed to cause a short-term disruption and to send a message to Tehran that the US have the capability to target the ship. And next time it might be a missile or a torpedo rather than a cyber attack. That's me speculating, but I wonder if that's the case. I think Biden's, again, cautious to escalate too far of Iran and doesn't want to necessarily sink the ship. So you've got option B that's still effective and sends a signal. That might be what they've done. And I think we said in one of our previous episodes, these airstrikes against the Houthis is all well and good, but really the ability for the Houthis to target and attack the ships needs to be addressed. That means destroying all electronic targeting systems and disrupting ammunition supplies, because if the Houthis no longer have rockets or targeting systems, then their threat is largely gone. So I think sorting out that ship, it is providing targeting information for the Houthis to use for them to then, you know, target a particular cargo ship. It's not only putting the lives of the crews of the cargo ships at risk, but it's also putting the lives of those trying to defend those cargo ships at risk as well. So, and those are personnel from, you know, our home countries. So, yeah, it's, I think that spy ship is a menace, and sooner or later it needs to be sorted out.
One thing that stood out to me is it's rare to see details on specific tactical offensive cyber operations. You know, I mean, the DoD doesn't comment on them at all. Like, it's very little of what happens inside U.S. Cyber Command or within the NSA is disclosed. Yeah. So yeah, it's rare to see something specific. I mean, I think it was wise to believe at the time of our retaliation for Tower 22, which was the attack in Jordan that killed three U.S. service members, wise to include that the response included things other than just those airstrikes. You know, there could have been, I mean, yeah, we know about this cyber attack on this specific spy ship. There could have been others on Iranian units in the Middle East or even inside Iran itself that we still don't know about.
Yeah.
That's entirely possible. I think it's probably likely that is the case. You know, and you saw a few days after the airstrikes, there was a leader of Qatab Hezbollah, one of the bigger Iranian-backed militias in Iraq and Syria. I believe the guy was heading up their kind of aircraft drone division. Yeah. He was killed in a drone strike in Baghdad. It's one of those one of those missiles with the blades that come out, you know.
Oh yes. I don't know what I mean. I can't remember what it's called, but I know exactly what he means.
Yeah, like the ninja kind of things, right?
Yeah, because it doesn't have an explosive, does it? So it just uses the blades to kill people and energy.
Yeah, it was one of those that hit the car, like in rush hour traffic, and damaged nothing else other than just that car.
Yeah.
And I think since then, I didn't ask Philip if this is entirely, as far as I know, there's only been, since those airstrikes, I mean, yes, the Houthis have continued what they're doing in the Red Sea, but as far as the PMF, which is, you know, the coalition of militias throughout Iraq and Syria that were responsible for Tower 22, as far as I know, there was only, on February 4th, there was an attack on a training ground run by the Syrian Democratic Forces, which are allied with us, where U.S. forces are present. There was an attack there. But since then, I don't believe there have been any others. So in a way, it kind of worked, you know? They stopped. Yeah. Strike stopped.
Well, there we go.
Yeah.
That's good. Well, let's hope they don't resume, but yeah.
Yeah.
Good deterrence there. Well, this is the sad reality, which I think some people forget, is rules do have to be enforced once in a while. And to do it sometimes requires actions that, you know, aren't necessarily the nicest, but they're the only ones that kind of cut through. So,
yeah. I mean, the Houthis are a different issue. Well, not entirely different, but they're it's more complicated than that. But yeah, as far as I've been able to glean, the militias have largely got the message, and they backed down, and we did it without a massive regional war with the Iranians.
Yeah, which is a good thing. So yeah.
Yes.
Yeah. Lessons to be learned from that.
That was the idea going into it.
Yeah, indeed. What is it? I mean, America wants isn't to get bogged down in another Middle Eastern war. You know, Biden was against quite a lot of the escalations in Afghanistan, wasn't he, during his time as vice president?
Yeah. He felt so strongly that the U.S. should get out of Afghanistan during the Obama administration that I believe he almost resigned as vice president.
Wow. So, yeah. So he's very, you know, I think the last person who's going to want to start a war in the Middle East. And it's kind of what you want from a president, really. You kind of want a president. I think this is where, you know, the proportionate response model is better than the full-blown war on terror model, because as soon as you start occupying countries and regions, you become the villain. Whilst if you can kind of just do a very targeted sort of specific strike against, terrorist X or facility Y, that's a better thing in the long run. Because there were even options to, during the Clinton administration, to kill bin Laden, but the Clinton administration was worried about the legality of it. But if they'd killed him, we might not have had 9/11. Might have had the war on terror. Can you imagine it? You know, imagine it. Sometimes, you know, taking out one person can save a whole lot of pain on a massive scale. I mean, wouldn't that be a really interesting parallel universe to explore? What would have happened if Bin Laden had been killed in 1998 or something? You know, yeah. I'd love to see that parallel universe. I think it might be more pleasant than the one we're currently in.
It would have been a lot better than the reality we have. Who knows?
Yeah.
Maybe something else terrible would have happened. Who knows?
Yeah, you never know. You never know. That's the thing. Usually there is something else, but there we go.
Yeah.
Well, that's a lovely cheery note to finish on. But Matt, are you up to anything exciting over the week ahead? Or?
I'm doing some editing for this podcast. There's an interview with Garrett Graff that I did the other week on his book on the U.S. government's efforts to investigate UFO sightings, you know, that kind of thing.
Cool.
Not a conspiracy theorist kind of book. No. It's just kind of rigid, and this is the facts, this is the history of how it happened. Same as with the Area 51 interview that we did. So that should be out in the next couple weeks or so, you know.
Cool. And I think he's quite good friends with Shane Harris. I think I've seen photos from Shane's Instagram of the book launch and stuff.
Garrett's a pretty pretty well-known investigative national security reporter. He's written books on 9/11, U.S. continuity of government planning, which is where Garrett and I first sort of corresponded over his efforts on that stuff. And, you know, my research as far as the novels are concerned along those lines.
Yeah.
He wrote a sort of a definitive history of Watergate that was a Pulitzer finalist. He did a limited podcast series on the American far right, which I wanted to get him on here to talk about. And then I saw this book on UFOs he was doing was coming out, so we did that instead.
It'll
be interesting interview. We talked about a lot of cool stuff in there.
Excellent. Well, I look forward to hearing that. Yeah, I mean, I've got my interview with Charles Beaumont to come out soon. It's just in post at the moment. I've got to disguise his voice. And Charles Beaumont's not his real name either. So this is the fun of being a former MI6 officer, and that's how you can talk publicly, just about. I thought that interview was quite interesting, actually. It sort of goes into some of the reality behind his novel. And I'm just sort of looking into other topics. So actually, some news, some personal-ish news. So I've got a new podcast starting about a TV show I used to love called Homicide: Life on the Street. So the podcast is called Homicide: Life on the Set, and we're due to release next Thursday, if all goes according to plan. We're just waiting on a thumbs up from someone. And we've had some really interesting guests. We've had Tom Fontana, who was the show's showrunner, and I believe he's won Emmys. He's certainly a very well-established writer and producer who did Sent Elsewhere, Homicide, Oz, Monsieur Spade, which is out at the moment with Clive Owen, and other stuff. And then we've had Carl Secor, who was one of the stars of the show, and a few other interesting guests too. So I'm hoping it's a monthly podcast and just sort of going into the making of that show. And I really loved Homicide. It's always been quite a profound show, which is quite rare for TV a lot of the time these days to get something that's profound, but especially as a crime procedural kind of thing. It was a very different kind of cop show, and it was kind of about the nature of life and death as you investigate death. So I quite like that. That'll be out soon. So that's what I've been tinkering on for a little bit. So thank you for joining me today, Matt. I think we've tried our best to put the worlds to right. I hope we've not upset anybody, because I never intentionally want to upset anybody. It's it's such a, especially the Gaza topic, it's just so difficult to navigate. And sometimes it's just hard to find the right words to say. And usually when we've released an episode, you think, oh, actually, I've got to put that a better way, but you know,
sometimes
we just,
there isn't,
we can do what we can.
Sometimes, especially with this issue, there's just nothing you can say. I mean, whatever you say, someone's gonna take it out of context, or you know, take what you didn't say and then draw like the most extreme kind of extrapolation
that. If you don't mention oranges, you must be an orange hater or
right.
Something. Yeah.
Yeah. I don't know. So you do the best you can.
Yeah. Indeed. Indeed. Well, thank you, everybody, for listening. I hope you all have a lovely weekend and look after yourselves. And we'll be back in a couple of weeks with two more episodes for you and some more exciting interviews coming up. So thank you for your support. We really do appreciate it. We've got some new new followers, new Patreon subscribers have joined us. So thank you very much. And we will catch you on the next one. Thank you, Matt.
Bye, guys.